This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for March 2008. I'm Don Scher, senior editor of Poetry Magazine. Christian Wyman, the editor of Poetry, joins me by phone this month from windy Southwest Texas, where he's been trying to get some writing of his own done. Hi, Chris. Getting any work done down there?
I am, you know, writing lots of odes to wild pigs and rattlesnakes.
Well, put those in a mail with a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Right, submit them anonymously.
Anonymously.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, on this month's podcast, we're going to hear a poem in the March issue by Angie Malenko.
We can teach an artist to teach, but we can't teach a teacher to be an artist. How true, the guests murmured.
And a poem by Terrence Hayes.
The bar noise makes a kind of silence. When Orpheus hands me his sunglasses, I see how fire changes everything.
We're also going to hear them talk a bit about their poems, reflecting something different that we're doing in the March issue.
Yeah, we thought it would be interesting this month to actually have the poets answer questions about their poems to try to give readers a deeper experience with the poem. And we have Campbell McGrath and Jory Graham and Carl Kirchway, as well as a few others. One of my favorites here is by A.E. Stallings, and it's a poem called The Catch, and there's an ominous sense of this poem that builds throughout and becomes strange, but even stranger when you realize that the poem is about a baby. I'm on the phone, so Don, why don't you read the first few lines of this poem?
Sure. The catch. Something has come between us. It will not sleep. Every night it rises like a fish out of the deep. It cries with a human voice. It aches to be fed. Every night we heave it weeping into our bed. With its heavy head lolled back, its limbs hanging down, like a mer creature fetched up from the weeds of the drowned.
The poem goes on and becomes clear after a few minutes talking about a new baby, although it's cast in this sort of mythological frame. And the poem ends like this.
This is the third thing that makes father and mother, the fierce love of our fashioning that will have no brother.
And what I really admire about this poem, besides its formal accomplishment, is the ambivalence, really true ambivalence, that she manages to convey in the poem, ambivalence about motherhood.
It's a real twist, too, isn't it? Because the poem starts off with a simile that this thing that came between these sleeping people, this couple, rises like a fish every night. And she says in the Q&A that simile is arguably a species of metaphor. But although we usually think of a simile meaning something that's like something else, this is about creatures being unlike each other.
Yeah, and she calls it the catch. You know, you think of a catch as a fish, maybe, and a prize that you get. Also, the catch is a mate. But then there's the other meaning where something has a catch to it. And so this poem expresses dual meanings perfectly.
A couple poems that go together for me in this issue are the two by W.S. DiPiero, Johnny One Note, which is a poem for Bobby Hutcherson in Oakland, the vibes player, is a kind of jazz poem, and the second poem, Pacific Surfliner, now arriving San Diego, is a train poem. In the Johnny One Note poem, there's something about the tone that he hears in this jazz performance that kind of escapes the room in which it's created in this music, and he says, it passes through the walls, mortared pores, to reverb in the cool night air of an unpeopled sidewalk, droning toward tracks where a passing people train sucks up and winds his finely found wowed tone around its wheels.
That wall's mortared pores and that finely found wowed tone, such energy compressed in so little space.
In that line, you can almost see the wheels, finely found wowed tone around its wheels. Those O's in there are kind of like the wheels. And then the second poem in the pair is about a train, the Pacific Surfliner, as it rolls into San Diego. And in this poem, he's looking for someone, and people are kind of milling around. And the someone he's looking for, he says, could have been anybody from everywhere, like Ellis Island's ghosts, their dump of cardboard valises, bindles, baby fat sacks strangled by hemp. And around me here, long-haul lovers who in sleepers last night loved to exhaustion. So the poems kind of go together, the sort of movement of, I guess, human relations and sounds and the things that we create and carry with us.
You know, I used to live in San Francisco, and I lived right around the corner from W.S.D. Piero, and I would see him at the train stop or in the train, and he would just be fixated on things. He's never happier than when he's in a completely jam-packed train. And it's interesting to have that personal reference with these poems, because the poems are just so attentive to those microscopic details. They make them so alive.
Yeah, and yet there's still that feeling of kind of being lost. You never quite find out who it is he's looking for, or if he ever finds that person, how they ever meet up. There's sort of the loneliness of things that are left out. So it's richly described, but it doesn't force an experience on you.
Also in this issue is a handful of poems by Terence Hayes, who's making his first appearance in Poetry Magazine.
Well, one of the things Terence Hayes does really well is that he balances these living voices, kind of from his neighborhood, his everyday life, with the formal diction of poetry. And what arises from all this are these great characters in the poems, guys with names like Big Trend and Stick.
The great thing is they don't feel like literary contrivances. They feel uprooted from a real world.
In the poem we're going to hear, Cocktails with Orpheus, that title might make you think we're in for a metamorphosis of some kind. And
right,
in a way, we...
This woman, Miss Geneva.
Yeah.
A very lively character from the poet's past. And some moment of incredible intensity that he shared with her, which he's remembering, is in this poem.
So in the magazine, we do have a Q&A with Terence Hayes following the poems. But for the podcast, we asked him for his introductory remark.
I think of it as a sort of a strange dream poem. Although it's, you know, it's fairly rooted in a kind of an experience, although the person that I was with in the bar was not named Orpheus. But Miss Geneva's name is real. I mean, the woman who's mentioned is a real person.
The poem begins in a bar, and the speaker remembers a woman he once lusted for, Miss Geneva. Here's Terence Hayes reading Cocktails with Orpheus.
After dark, the bar full of women, part of me loves, the part that stood naked outside the window of Miss Geneva, recent divorcee, who owned a gun. Oh, Miss Geneva, where are you now? Orpheus says she did not perish. She was not turned to ash in the brutal light. She found a good job. She made good money. She had her own insurance and a house. She was a decent wife. I know dissent lives in the word decent. The bar noise makes a kind of silence. When Orpheus hands me his sunglasses, I see how fire changes everything. In the mind, I am behind a woman whose skirt is hiked above her hips, as bound as touch permits, saying, "Don't forget me when I become the liquid out of which names are born, salt milk, milk sweet and animal made. I want to be human above the body, uprooted and right, a fold of pleas released. But I am a black wound, what's left of the deed."
You know, I was thinking when I was rereading this poem, it could have been a good, solid contemporary poem that we would have puzzled over and thought, well, maybe we should publish this, maybe we don't. And then suddenly in those last two lines, it just swerves into another dimension.
I want to be human above the body, uprooted and right, a fold of pleas released. But I am a black wound, what's left of the deed.
Syntactically and musically and thematically, that's really terrific. Now on to another poem in the March issue by Angie Mlenko called Conversion Comedy. Conversion Comedy, she says, is about religious doubt.
And I'm a little surprised to be writing about that subject, although I grew up Catholic and was a very religious child. And I associate poetry from way back with religion. So now I find myself thinking that all poetry comes from a religious impulse.
And this poem may seem a little convoluted, but that's because it's quoting from all kinds of different people who turn up in the poem. It's quoting from an abbot. It's quoting from her mother. And it talks about the Roman gods and the Christians looking around them. And maybe because it is the way we read things, where everything pops in and pops up and we quote them and repurpose them, that it does somehow in the end get all the way back to that religious impulse that she says poetry starts with.
There's a certain difficulty in a poem like this, and you have to experience a poem like this not as a sort of linear thing where you're figuring your way out from step to step, but you have to just let these associations occur to you and then see what kind of cumulative experience you have at the end.
I think it would be helpful to know that the poem is written, is addressed to an actual person, an Episcopal priest whose mom was an artist.
We're going to do something a little different for this podcast. We're going to interrupt it periodically to talk about the poem in various places. Here's Angie Malenko reading Conversion Comedy.
I thought of you as a butterfly tonight, getting to eschatology from a sketch pad, your mom's. And though you write sermons nice and linear, you also digress and about face. The Jeroboam trees are dark tonight, darker in the outage than the stars let the sky be. Partiers all. The abbot told you, I do not have power. The archbishop does not have power. The pope does not have power. Only God has power. Then it is not a kind of violence to put a photo of the pope in a luscious hacienda imperiled by a miniature pull bell. Someone admired the hostess's oils. Yes, it was a surprise when they hired me to teach, but they said, we can teach an artist to teach, but we can't teach a teacher to be an artist. How true, the guests murmured.
Lovely the way that she changes tone so radically. She creates a way in which she can bring in all kinds of different language so that you can have a line that suddenly partiers all, or darker in the outage than the stars that the sky be. These lyrical moments juxtapose right up against pieces of conversation that she's probably heard.
Just when things get to be very serious, like all that investigation of who has the power, then all these voices kind of pop in and fall away again.
This was not your mother, though artists all say it comes from somewhere else. When another guest compared the Catholic to the Episcopal service, she said, I think not. In a desert once, I almost fell off a cliff.
And that's a bit of a cliffhanger, isn't it? It just sort of disrupts the poem immediately there. Having fallen off a cliff, then the poem continues.
To calm me down, a friend told a joke. Descartes was sitting on a plane. The stewardess said, coffee or tea? I think not, Descartes said, and vanished.
You don't usually get a detachable joke in a poem where it actually works.
It took a moment to sink in because I thought he said the cart, as in beverage cart. Confusion is the only way to get to eschatology from a sketch pad. I'm trying to redeem that abbot, drawing in the outage.
That's a great line. Drawing in the outage can be sort of drawing in the darkness.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah. It also can be drawing in the outage, creating art in this darkness, so that art becomes both of those things at once.
Once you suggest the origins of music lay in the necessity of drowning out the cries of sacrificial victims, I start listening for them, the cries, under my own singing.
You wouldn't have suspected that the poem could have gotten to this point from all that has been said so far. Suddenly, a sort of trapdoor opens beneath you and it becomes much more serious.
Scholars resurrect books all the time just by quoting them. When Roman gods popped out of the soil, the Christians looked around wildly. Sculpt the mouth around sculpture, opt. They reburied them hurriedly, and the earth gulped.
That's pretty unexpected, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great rhyme, though, because if you have to figure out what rhymes with gulped, ulped will do nicely.
The statue of the Commendatore went down with Don Giovanni. Which shall I believe, the unrepentance of this sinkhole Don, or the statue that converts Leontes by resurrecting his all-forgiving wife? Hermione, who's peerless, has a likeness. He who won't about face is not mocked by art, but brought post-haste to hell, his shapely seat and heart. The moon slips out like a foreign coin from denim, a drachma, an ass. Can we redeem it?
Here we have a piece of the poem where there are things in quotation marks and italics, and the lines really start careening. And then they sort of tighten up suddenly when the poem asks,
can we redeem it?
That's pretty concise.
Yeah, and the answer is?
Cities are places of conversion, you said, but I am cityless. She ascended to the throne, you wrote by mistake, of Elizabeth.
So that's the end of the poem.
Right, and I think the poem leaves us with the speaker who's poised between these options, faith and disbelief, and doesn't really choose either way.
You can hear Angie Malenko read it all the way through herself without our color commentary on our website, poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Curtis Fox with Ed Herman.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman.
Thanks for listening.